Welcome. This is the .NET Open Q&A panel. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. We have mics, a mic over here and a mic over here. So if you have a question, I encourage you to stand up and walk up to the mic. If you do yell one out, we'll repeat it so everyone else can hear. I believe with that, that's all we really need.
No, we should do intros.
Oh, do intros. Do they want to know who we are?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll start then because I'm talking.
Yes, because you're still talking.
Okay, great. So I'm Damien Edwards. I'm a program manager for .NET on the server, and I spend most of my day thinking about ASP.NET Core.
I'm Mike Harsh. I'm a GPM on the Windows platform team, so I spend most of my time thinking about .NET on the client.
Yeah, I'm Emil Landroth. I'm a PM on the .NET platform team. I think about APIs on all the platforms, so I get to fix up the mistakes other people make. So I also work on .NET Standard, and that's probably the thing that most people know me for.
My name is Rich Lander. I'm also a program manager. I work on .NET Framework, .NET Core, and .NET for UWP. So, it's because I said UWP.
Too soon.
Yeah.
Power.
So I make sure that all those things that we build, runtimes or frameworks, we can put them into boxes and ship them out to folks around the world to build applications.
Who's going to open this up? Who wants to ask the first question? Someone has to go first. Yes, sir.
So I get the .NET Core compatibility, and I run it in my project, in my solution, and I get an output list of stuff that isn't there, and then what?
So, portability analyzer, I think you're referring to, the .NET portability analyzer.
The question is, repeat the question.
So the question was around, I have some code, some .NET code. I run this tool that tells me whether my code will work on .NET Core. That's called the portability analyzer. And it spits out some stuff. And then what do I do now? Like, it says, yes, you are 67% compatible. Well done. Your app will crash only 33% of the time. Imo, do you want to recommend what people in that position should do next?
Question your life choices is a good starting point. No, the one thing that you should immediately try is, like, if you haven't tried .NET Core 2.0, you should try 2.0, because 2.0, one of the things we have done is we have a ton of APIs to 2.0 to make that list really short. So ideally, you should not get, 65% compatibility. You should get high 80s, high 90s. You're not even 100% for the most part if it's libraries.
For the most part, we look at the higher layer of things. If you look, look at, let's say, WinForms or ASP.NET, some of the stuff just has technological replacements wholesale, where you have to rewrite those parts of your library or application in order to take advantage of .NET Core. And then there's other pieces where we have smaller technologies where you just have to pick a different overload, or you have to pick a different member, a different type. And usually, API port, if you look at the output window, there's this little small triangle very often where you can extend basically the error message, and it should give you a recommendation in text form. If it doesn't exist, again, question your life choices. But more importantly, go to GitHub and basically just check out our API port GitHub repo and file bugs for that, because we really should have recommendations for those cases if we don't have them.
One thing to add on that is we have a couple of teams that we work directly with. One team works with internal Microsoft teams porting to .NET Core, and the other one works with external companies, helping them do the same thing. And one thing one of these people recently shared with us is they've actually, as they moved to .NET Core 2.0, they actually were able to stop using that tool and instead just rely on the compiler. And the reason was because the number of incompatibilities and errors is now so much smaller that just relying on the regular compiler input was actually more intuitive and easy for that particular person, which I regarded as a great sign.
Right.
So, I was going from, it's in framework now, and would like to go to Core, so that we get.
Yeah, so I think that everything we just said still applies.
Yeah, so I think that's a plug to go get Visual Studio 2017 update through preview and try out the .NET Standard 2.0 tooling.
So the other thing I want to add is every time we run the tool, we send telemetry back so we know what 37% you're not compatible with. And we use that report as well to make sure that we file recommendations or actually add the APIs to the product. So even if you don't get answers that you care about, we get all the answers so we can actually help future yourself or future other people to not run into that. So keep running the tool.
Don't keep on
I didn't quite hear the question.
The question was, in .NET Core, is pinvoke still supported?
Yes.
So you can, pinvoke remains our primary native interop solution. So you can pinvoke on Windows, you can pinvoke on Mac, you can pinvoke on Linux. And in fact, that's exactly what our libraries do. Yeah, so COM interop is something we do not support in .NET Core, because COM is fundamentally a Windows technology. But pinvoke works everywhere. What about MSMQ?
We don't have support for MSMQ yet.
On .NET Core.
It's one of those things that we have on our list of things to think about, whether we want to replace that ported or.
If we did, it would be a Windows-only thing. So
yes.
There's a chance that we'll do, well, not a chance. We are looking at doing some, there are some missing pieces. The most common ones we hear from customers are imaging, system drawing, directory services, I've heard MSMQ. It's likely that we will actually build Windows-only versions of those for people.
Yeah.
And then what you'll probably see us do in .NET Core, more on Damien's team, I think, is I see us doing abstractions on top of some of those things. So if you want to do queuing as a full feature, we have a pluggable abstraction inside of like ASP.NET. And you could plug MSMQ in, you could plug RabbitMQ in, Service Bus, whatever. So likely in .NET Core proper, abstractions for these types of things, and then implementations, we would port some of the Windows ones.
Right. So I mean, I think the overarching the sort of thing to take away from that is if you have applications on .NET Framework today, the gamut, like the spread of the type of APIs you could call within that ecosystem was almost boundless. Like it's very difficult to say, let's go and build a new .NET that runs everywhere and just works. All that code will just continue to work. So this is a journey. This is not V1, it's not V2. This is something we're going to continue to work on over time.
Yep.
And there are new restrictions, or restrictions might be a strong word. There are new variables and new boundaries that we have to consider.
Characteristics.
Build in new characteristics, thank you. When building a .NET that runs everywhere. And yeah. So we need feedback from customers by running the portability tools, the analyzers, by having conferences like this, so that we can make the right decisions about what do we invest in next? Well, system.directory services is the number one thing I hear from certainly my customers, ASP.NET customers, who want to get very deep integration into their existing Active Directory story. So that's something that we've heard and we have plans to go off and do. And I think you'll see us do, frankly, probably we should do a better job of ensuring that outline is clear, that roadmap is clear, and I think it's something we all have to commit to doing.
Yeah, I think post-build, I think, and really as we get closer to the 2.0 release this summer, I think you'll see us give you a list of all the things on our roadmap of, as Damien says, I think the two we hear the most are directory services and imaging.
Yeah.
That's everybody, those are the number one and two things. I also hear WSFed quite a bit as well.
Yep.
We'll just put those on the roadmap and show you what we're going to do with those things. And some of those will be Windows only, and some of those will be cross-platform, right, depending on what the tech is.
Yep. It's also worth mentioning is that because we started with a Windows-only code base, most of the stuff that is OS-specific right now is only Windows.
Right.
But we will also probably in the future add components that are Linux-only or macOS-only, if that makes sense, right?
It's like we don't have a daemon store yet on Linux, and that seems like an obvious thing to go build.
Yeah. In fact, we had a pull request to ASP.NET Core a few weeks ago from a Red Hat engineer providing a Linux-specific transport for our web server, for Kestrel. We've done the work in the new version of Kestrel to allow simple, an abstraction that allows you to plug in different transports. So we were based on something called libuv before, which is a C library that abstracts eventing and socket stuff. But we were tied to that directly at the hip. In the new version, we can supplant it. We can use system.sockets, system.net.sockets. We can use a Linux-specific transport, and the open source community, or us, can build these different transports so we can light up the best experience, hopefully, on existing platforms and new platforms as they emerge. Like if you're running on a Raspberry Pi or running on a watch or goodness knows what, I can't even think of yet, we may need to build new layers to plug those things in. And so those things are slowly evolving.
Is that where Rio would fit in too?
Rio is another great example. Registered IO, which was a new extension to WinSock that was added in Windows 8. Which sort of fundamentally changes some of the models for doing high-performance networking in Windows. I'd love for us to be able to light that up when running specifically on Windows environments that support it. And we've actually got experiments of doing that already. But again, it's just a matter of prioritizing and triaging and those type of things. And there are even new standards coming along. There's Packet Direct in Windows 2012 or 2016 and above, and I'm sure there'll be another one after that. And so, yeah.
Next question.
Let's let's use the first mic.
Okay. Ah, I see.
Question about the task-based asynchronous pattern on the server. Every single call, await task, dot configure await false. Is there something we can do to have that set globally for everything in the app domain?
So that's an interesting question. So we could probably be multiple sides of this, could answer this, because depending on the configure await false sort of paradigm on the task-based or the task asynchronous programming model, in various Windows, in various .NET application models, we have the concept of a synchronization context. It's this sort of silent marshal that sits in the background and says, okay, well, I have more than one thread and stuff that has to get done, but this stuff can only happen on that thread. And where you see this most often, obviously, is in graphic Windows programming, right? Where you have a form in which is, you know, the main UI thread is linked to the Windows concept of message pumping and all the stuff that I understand because I'm a server guy. But if you run stuff not on that thread, you can't do certain things. And so when you use the async await pattern, we need to ensure that the callback or the second half of your method, a bit after that, runs in the right place. And so by default, we capture whatever context you're on to start with, and then when the async await happens, we put you back on that context silently. You used to have to do that stuff manually. In server programming, we don't have a similar concept. There's no concept of a UI thread. The closest, in fact, it's multi-threaded and highly parallel by default because you have to handle hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of simultaneous requests. In system web, that is ASP.NET that ships in the .NET framework, there is a synchronization context behind the scenes. And it's more about ensuring that when you write code that interops with generally shared .NET code that might be not really making an assumption about where it's running. I could be on a server. I could be in a Windows form application. I don't really know. If they start introducing parallelism, we have a safeguard to ensure that multiple threads aren't trying to interact with a single request at the same time. Because as you can imagine, if I'm busy writing a response to a browser and more than one thread wants to write a tag at the same time, disaster entails, right? Like you start getting half of elements in one place and another. As a result, our programming model in ASP.NET is not thread safe by default. Those primitives that you use, HTTP context, those type, they're not thread safe. You can't write to those from multiple threads at the same time. So we needed a synchronization context over there to interact with the rest of the framework, which was written like this. In the new world of .NET Core, in ASP.NET Core, we don't have a synchronization context. There's no UI stack on .NET Core today. It's fundamentally right now a console app model and a server programming model. And so we don't do configure await false throughout our code base because we don't have a synchronization context to tell not to do it. Now, that can introduce problems when you try and lift that code and run it in a place that does have a synchronization context. The biggest one we run into is unit testing frameworks today. Now, that's my spiel about how it works in servers. Whether specifically to the question about could we do something around making it easy for library developers and not have to do this everywhere, that's probably an interesting question for the BCL.
Well, I've got one thrown yes. as well, which is we, in the .NET talk, Casey from my team was actually talking about some FXCOP rules that we have. And there is actually an FXCOP rule around this exact pattern. Mm-hmm. And with this stuff, which will be shipping as part of VS 2017 Update 3, you will be able to actually force that to be a build error if you wanted to in your application.
If you don't call configure await false.
Yes, you can basically set that as a policy, and it's done in a way that you can actually attach that policy to each project.
We've already written a custom Roslyn analyzer that does just that.
We actually have an analyzer we're going to ship in the box that does exactly this, and we have a mechanism now where you can actually specify configuration for such things at a project level. So you could actually go say, for these projects, the rules are you got to do it this way, and you'll get the errors. That's the tooling aspect of it. That's what we'll say. If Emo wants to talk about the framework aspect of it, I'll throw it to him. So,
well, it's one of those examples where, I mean, I've heard proposals where you put an attribute on the assembly, and then within that particular project, we always do configure wait false. And we have thought about this. The problem with these kind of things is, as Damien said, like if you do it the right way, it's all good. If it's the wrong way, really bad things happen. And so this is one of those examples where you can argue being explicit is better than being implicit. Because even if we have an analyzer, you can still say, no, in this particular instance, the analyzer is wrong, and you suppress that instance and you know better, you document it, than if you just silently make your code do crazy stuff that you may not intended it to do. That being said, there's also this discussion of like what is the majority customer scenario. Is the developer scenario usually you want configure await false or you want configure await true? And the default that we have for UI programming in particular, we think is a good model because you don't have to do crazy gymnastics to make sure that after you've, you know, read the disk asynchronously, you can just add the items to the list box and nothing bad happens. And there are so many examples right now where that is the right behavior, that we think the default is still the right one. It doesn't mean that we can give you a different default. And there are discussions around that, but we haven't closed on that, I think.
It sounds like that's a vote from you that the default change is a good, it might be a powerful gun, but it's a one that you'd like to have.
Yes.
Okay.
The analyzer is good, though.
Yes, sir.
So as most of us probably were pretty surprised when we saw snapshots yesterday, I have an in-production .NET Core 1.0 application and found out today that snapshots cannot be ran against that application. So I'm kind of given the opportunity of trying to upgrade the tooling to 2.0 or fall back to 4.6. So I guess, is there a particular reason why we didn't decide to snapshots
or make it available for 1.0 or 1.0? Debug snapshots? Is that what you're referring to?
I don't know. It's tied. I was not aware it was tied to any particular technology.
I think it is because I think I know.
I was told it's expert-centered.
Right. So I think what it is that they required the new APIs in .NET Core 2 that come by way of .NET Standard 2 to do global exception handling, is my understanding. In order, which that API does not exist in .NET Core. There is actually no way in .NET Core to register a single callback in the process that will get called when any exception occurs and leaks out. That's required when you build a tool that detects that and takes a dump of the process for you. So that only exists in .NET Core 2, as it is right now.
So for 4.6, is it just a NuGet package yet?
So in 4.6, that capability in the runtime already exists via appdomain. Whatever it is,
yeah.
Get global exception, whatever it is. And so they were able to do that there. But that same API or an equivalent now exists in .NET Core in 2, so they can build those tools to do that. And I think that's part of just, again, reminding people that .NET Core 1 was very much a version 1, and we have accelerated, I think, version 2 from what we originally planned. I think it's fair to say that, you know, we really only RTM'd version 1 in March this year with the advent of the tooling for Visual Studio 2017 after we had that reset from Project JSON back to CSproj. And we took the opportunity with .NET Standard 2 coming along after the working with the Xamarin team to sort of come up with this core set of APIs for .NET across platform to say, you know what, we really have to get this on .NET Core. And that really means doing a major version. And then also looking at things that we're missing, like the ability for profilers and debuggers to attach globally in a simple way without having to invent new mechanisms to do so. So there was stuff missing in .NET Core 1. I mean, that's kind of the easy way of saying that. And we certainly hope that a lot of that stuff is back in .NET Core 2, and we'll be able to move forward from there. Yes, sir.
From what I understand, SQL R,
Yes.
What I was wondering is it going to be much different from a user perspective as well? Like the client side, we have to change a lot of stuff, or is it just going to work as it is right now?
Can you repeat the question?
I will, please? Yeah. So the question was around ASP.NET SignalR, which we've had two versions of on the previous ASP.NET technology. And we're currently working on right now for ASP.NET Core. It is going through quite a large, it's basically a complete rewrite from scratch. I mean, the underlying primitives are fundamentally different now. And we learned a lot after shipping two versions of a framework that attempted to make everything incredibly simple. In some cases, too simple, to the point that it made it hard for us to solve issues that occur when we make things so simple for developers. And now I'm doing a talk on this tomorrow with David Fowler, so I encourage you to come to that talk. But the short story is, yes, some things will change. Some features will be removed because they're simply too difficult for us to take a default opinion on and present an API over. They're really app concerns that the developer has to deal with themselves. But when it comes to the client, you'll have most of the same capabilities that you're used to today with SignalR. There will be new clients. So we have a Swift client now for, you know, Apple devices. We have a C++ client. We have a new TypeScript-based JavaScript client. We have a new C# client. We intend on writing a new Java client, again, from scratch. And because a bunch of the architecture under the covers has changed, we've been able to remove a lot of the complexity in how the client talks to the server. I think today in SignalR, it takes 4 requests before you can actually start talking. For pure WebSocket clients, we're getting that down to 1. So you basically establish the WebSocket connection, and you're connected. And that's we kind of started from that premise. So there will be some differences, but we think it's for the better. So.
I think this is the question you asked at the booth. Yes. So I think we said we didn't have the right. Oh, the question was, can you initialize a thread pool with a minimum set of threads and make sure it never falls below that number? The answer we gave before was we didn't quite actually have the right person at the booth to answer that specific question. Definitely understand the need. So no better answer than I gave last time. Go ahead, Mr. T-shirt. Sure.
So what would be the right time to start thinking about that?
Well, what do you intend to use the application for?
Right now, we just have our web application, like worker role, and so we're going to use it for app services, that kind of application. And so we are perfectly fine with Revit.net. So what would be the right time to think about that?
First off, I think there's two there's two good reasons to look.
Do you want to repeat the question?
Yeah, that's it. When do you use .NET Core? Okay. If you have a web application, when would you decide to use .NET Core over .NET Framework? And I was just answering a similar question earlier, and I'll let Damien answer as well. But .NET Core has two big changes over .NET Framework. One is it's cross-platform. So if you need Windows, Mac, and Linux, if you need cross-platform support, then .NET Core is something you should think about. .NET Core also is side by side, and you can embed it in your application. So if you actually have a case where you want to have a web application on your machine, take advantage of the latest framework, and you can't today because you have to wait until your IT or yourself can move the newest .NET onto that box. Those are the two big advantages that .NET Core gives you right out of the box. Is I can take a .NET Core application, compile .NET Core into the actual app itself, and so I don't touch anything, any .NET on the machine. So I'm completely standalone. Those to me are the big high-level primitives of if I was going to make a decision today of moving between one or the other. If you need one of those two things right away, then great time to move to .NET Core. I can let Damien answer the ASP.NET aspect of that.
Yeah, I mean, the third one, to be completely honest, is obviously I think we can evolve .NET Core and the stacks on top of it quicker because it's side by side because of the second one. .NET Framework is on over 1.5 billion machines globally. So we don't take the decision to change .NET Framework lightly. This isn't a war stories panel, but we could tell you war stories about trying to make innocent bug fixes in .NET Framework and then having our butts kicked when it had unintended side effects when we thought we were doing the right thing. And that was one of the first things I learned coming to Microsoft 7 years ago. It's like, I'm going to fix all these bugs that have been plaguing me as a developer, as an ASP.NET developer. And I quickly realized that if I fix something here innocently, I am probably going to break conservatively tens of thousands of applications that, for whatever reason, were relying on that buggy behavior. And you know, the Windows guy can probably back that up with even worse stories, right?
Yeah.
So
bugs become features real quick.
Bugs become features as soon as you ship them.
Yep.
And so we introduced all types of gymnastics in .NET Framework to try and allow us to work around that. But the reality is that's just there's a limit to what you can scale there. And so .NET Core, because of that number two feature, because it is side by side by nature, and you can embed it in your application, it gives you isolation and portability. And so if you want to take advantage of the latest and greatest features that we are building as a team, whether it be in .NET Core itself or in ASP.NET Core or some other framework on top, and the truth is you will get them quicker in .NET Core, on top of .NET Core, simply because we can. We can do it without fear of breaking everyone's applications when the next Windows update goes out. Application developers can just choose when they want to take those particular features into their applications. They can test them in isolation. If it works for that app, they don't have to worry about it breaking anything else. That would be the only one I'd add to those two.
I would say that you just tied speeds predominantly to the self-contained aspect, but the other thing that's also true is .NET Core is open source.
That's true.
So that means our whole engineering system for building it and getting actually binaries is also open because it's part of the open source, you know, GitHub repo, if you will. You clone the repo, you can build the repo, right? So we have invested quite a bit in making the engineering system approachable by mere mortals versus if you want to build something that ships with Windows, there's a bunch more machinery that we have to kick off in order to get a new build out of the door. And so like you can basically git clone the repo, you know, add an API, fix the bug, and 15 minutes later you have something you can actually run on. And that is something that we just can't do realistically with .NET Framework. And so speed is something that goes, you know, not just the deliverables, but also the way we actually build the product. It's much more transparent, it's much more open, it's much more, you know, agile, if you will.
The gentleman might have been at the mic first.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so kind of following along on that, you know, for those of us that have really fallen in love with .NET Core because of exactly what you said, it's fast and it, you know, it works better. We still, sitting next to us, have that big pile of legacy stuff that we've got to start kind of ripping apart and porting over. And for most of it now, especially with 2.0, you know, it's great. That API coverage is looking fantastic. We've got it. But we know, you know, some of us have stuff, those one or two things that are going to kind of be left behind. They're COM dependent, they're MSMQ. And one of the ways that we found real good success on kind of getting away from some of that and being able to tell that story to the business on the transition is, look, I can put an ASP.NET core API in front of that old thing that's on full framework and kind of looking for, you know, kind of your kind of guidance looking ahead to how long are we going to be able to tell that story? How long are we going to be able to say, look, ASP.NET core is going to have the ability to run on full framework and, you know, not going to drift into being just core because, you know, you guys love that kind of iterated speed on doing core. So are we good for a while? Are we going to be able to use that? ASP.NET Core will stick on full framework, and we can kind of make that our bridge to get us off of full framework and onto core for, you know, all of our legacy stuff?
I would actually, even before I answer that question, that part of the question, I would say one of the things that I see a lot when I go talk to customers, first off, one of the strongest messages we want to tell everybody in the room, .NET Framework is not going anywhere. So, you know, when I hear somebody say, I need to move off of .NET Framework, you don't have to move off of .NET Framework. The ASP.NET, the Web API, the SignalRs, mm-hmm. the Entity Frameworks that work on .NET Framework are not going to go away. They're not going to not be supported.
WinForms.
Yeah, and WPF and WinForms, too.
WebForms, well WinForms, all these things, that tech is not going away.
Is it going to continue to be, you know, as advanced? I mean, are we going to get more MVC on the old side, or is that really, are you shifting your focus more to ASP.NET Core?
I think you'll see most of the innovation happen in ASP.NET Core. We have talked as a team, maybe there's things that we backport from ASP.NET Core into some of the older stuff. I think it's going to depend on what we hear from customers around that, but where I was also going in this is a lot of folks, when I go talk to them, they're like, they have some of these older things, and I'm like, at least when I was in the IT world, I never would have been given permission to rewrite everything with the new framework. So a lot of folks that I hear today, really what you want to do is, what I recommend to people is just take your older code and run it in a container and DevOps it the same way you would run .NET Core in a container the same way. So that's what we're seeing a lot of customers do is they're taking their older stuff, they're moving it into containers and just leaving it. I know one of the companies I deal with actually still is running classic ASP and they're like, why rewrite it? It works. There's no benefit to doing that. And so, you know, I was my first option always is don't rewrite everything.
Right.
Do greenfield stuff, brand new stuff with .NET Core as appropriate, and you know, that's kind of the modernize. So modernize slowly onto the new stack, leave your existing stuff where it is. That would be my default answer.
Sure.
I think there was also the ASP.NET Core on full framework.
Right.
Let's just curious. Why do you need to do that today?
It's because I've got, it's two things. It's MSMQ is one of them. It's also, it's a COM driver to an old piece of hardware that instead of nuketing that package around to all my other apps, I can start to make those other apps core and put an API in front of that, what used to be that library, and now I can go hit it, and it's really nice to write that as an ASP.NET Core library, you know, as an ASP.NET Core API in front of that old stuff that I kind of want to, you know, mask and hide away versus going and writing it in Web API, you know, on the full framework stuff.
Yeah, Damien can shoot me if he doesn't like my answer, but when it comes to if ASP.NET Core runs on full framework or not, ASP.NET Core 2 or 3 or whatever, we'll look at customer feedback and decide whether we should do that or not. Even if we do it, I want to let you know that you're going to find that they're going to diverge. Basically, as Damien was saying before, we can make .NET Core can go faster than .NET Framework can. And so what's going to happen is I think you're going to find that ASP.NET Core on .NET Core is going to move faster than if we decide to make it run on full framework. ASP.NET Core on full framework can't go as fast as ASP.NET Core on .NET Core because ASP.NET Core on .NET Core can depend on new .NET Core features that don't exist in .NET Framework. That's really the crux of our problem here is, are we willing to go bind ourselves and say ASP.NET Core can't go very fast because it's tied to .NET Framework? That really is the jux of the question for us. I don't think I have the right answer today.
Sure.
We might make ASP.NET Core 2 work on full framework to solve this problem for people that actually were asking about this over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. But how long do I do that? When is the time to do that? The big thing is we as a team have been thinking about is, and Damien was kind of alluding to this earlier, we want to put a roadmap up of all these missing pieces that might stop you from being able to move to ASP.NET Core on .NET Core and trying to address those as fast as we can. But we'll never address all of them. We'll get 50, 60% of those. We'll get the majority at some point.
Sure. Yeah, and you say, I think I totally get that. It really has been, for the last year, a really compelling story for us to be able to tell the business that, you know, I can get that one last piece ready to port, and when you finally give me enough leeway to get that last underlying dependency replaced, I switch to a different queuing mechanism, I get the new piece of hardware, then I can do the whole thing, right? Then I can roll the whole thing over, and you get all the cool stuff you see on TV. You know, you get all the containers, and all the fun magic that just sounds sexier than, you know, roll it up in a Windows container and ship it out. You know, because we love to use it. It's you build it's a really cool race car. I want to drive it, but I got to sell it. You know, I got to sell it to Dad a little bit before I can do it. So.
Is ASP.NET Core 1.1 good enough?
It's pretty darn close. Yeah, I mean it's got, for my limited use case, it's got a lot. But there are there's a ton of new stuff.
I'm just saying if we said ASP.NET Core 1.1 runs on .NET Framework for the next 3 years, is that good enough for you?
Knowing that MSMQ is never going to be potentially never going to be in any of the cores, probably for me, because that's
By the way, we didn't say MSMQ would not be in any of the cores. What we said is it would probably be a Windows only component that you could actually use in a core.
Okay.
So. If it's one of the big libraries, like there's, we mentioned a few libraries today. There's directory services, there's MSMQ, right. there's system drawing. Some of those we might actually just release as Windows only things because they're Windows techs. So we're not going to write an MSMQ for Linux or MSMQ for Mac.
Right.
So don't assume we're not going to give you shims. So you could actually still use those things.
Okay.
But they would be in some kind of Windows compat pack.
Okay.
They would not be in .NET Core.
Yeah. Just like registry
just like
today.
Registry. Exactly. We'll never make a registry for Linux.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, then,
But I'm hearing that ASP.NET Core 1.1 on full framework, that's enough for you?
If the support story on it truly is going to be 3-5 years, yeah. If the support story is going to be a month or a year after two drops in August, then
cool.
That feels a little tight.
Well, thanks for the feedback.
Sure.
I guess to this side of the room on the mic, we haven't had one that far from there, I think.
Yeah, thank you. You can hear me okay? So like the last question, very similar. Not all of us get to work on fancy new shiny toys, right? And a lot, even if we do, there's a lot of us that still probably have some legacy apps we have to support. So this question is regard to TLS 1.2. Maybe nobody really even cares or whatever, but like I have a government mandate from where I work where we have to deprecate and stop using anything that isn't TLS 1.2 compatible, right? So it goes back to legacy apps with .NET 3.5. And I know there's also a component at the OS level with regards to that, not just the framework level. So I think the life cycle on .NET 3.5 was it supported as long as the operating system it runs on is supported. And the last one is Server 2012 and Server 2012 R2, and those support TLS 1.2. But the 3.5 framework, does, at least I couldn't, maybe I'm not looking hard enough. You can't do TLS 1.2 in. You can do it in 4.5. But so here's my question is since 3.5 is kind of supported on Server 2012, and so the Server 2012 supports TLS 1.2, how hard would it be for you guys to patch it in so you could use TLS 1.2 in 3.5? I'm sorry, I just wanted to add one more thing to that. I don't think it's a small issue because like I deal with other vendor software from Fortune 500 companies, like enterprise-grade software, where they ship it to us and it's written in 3.5. And I shake my head a little bit, right? And they haven't upgraded and stuff like that. But I'm also to blame, too, because I have some legacy apps that are monolithic. I can't upgrade right away. I mean, Server 2012 support expires in 2023, so that buys me some time if you could patch that in there, right? And then there's a there's a software company that sells car dealership software to most of North America. And I interviewed on one of their product teams, and their thing was still written in 3.5 and WCF and WPF.
Oh, okay.
And things like that, the car industry, and they're shipping information over the wire in TLS 1.0.
Understood. Right? So just to, so other people have time for questions, is that the basic theme of the question?
Yeah.
So TLS is super important to us on both Windows and .NET Framework. Scott and I were just chatting back and forth. We definitely did TLS 1.2 in the 4.x products. We thought we had done it in 3.5 as well. So we don't have like a particular piece of syntax to show you at the moment. But we did do a TLS push, and we both recall having done that for 3.5.
I can circle back with you after this, son.
If you come up afterwards with an email address, we can have the person on our team that actually drives this follow up.
Okay.
But typically, we do push major security things that are required by platforms all the way down to
whatever is still out there.
This is different than what you asked. But so with the two major categories of like regulatory-oriented features that we build are TLS-type things, and then also crypto algorithms. The crypto algorithms we've only been putting into 4.x, but the TLS one, since it's so kind of pervasive of a feature, we thought we had put it into both places. But we can follow up with you later.
Okay, thanks.
Next one at the mic.
Eddie, I've got a question about app modernization.
By the way, just to answer that question, I did look it up, and there is a roll-up hotfix for 3.5 that adds support for TLS 1.2. Because we couldn't change the APIs, you have to enable it via a registry key, but it is out there for 3.5.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Can you set a registry key? Is that possible in the machines?
If you come up afterwards, we'll give you an email contact that can actually give you the article that actually shows you how to do this, but it is supported.
Sounds like that's a blog post we need to write.
I bet we, you mean you.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Right. So software modernization, especially on the client side, the past few years there have been a few cases where you've get in a situation where you start writing your code for, say, Windows Phone 7 or something like that, and then your code doesn't compile on 8.1, and now we're looking at UWP, which is another story. Are we going to see much more platform churn coming up in UWP?
Mike.
No is the short answer. The thing that we've been really pushing for in the last few years is to kind of, the legacy of UWP is from, you kind of mentioned the Windows 8 era, which was informed a lot by what happened in Phone 7, and really was designed as kind of, at least, let's just say the reputation is a little bit of not quite ready for desktop, caliber software, right? And that's a, something that we, on the platform team, have been really pushing across the general Windows Core team as a real issue and trying to push those things forward. And the advent and the announcement that we had today around .NET Standard 2.0 on UWPs is a real boon from that perspective, because not only do you get all the code sharing goodness of .NET Standard 2.0, but a lot of those things are enabled via Win32 APIs that weren't available previously to UWP applications. So that kind of also pushes the platform forward. And so the spirit of what we're going to be doing in the next few years is adding functionality to UWP to make it more of a desktop caliber platform, right? So the things that you wanted to do in your desktop apps, maybe not all the way up to like installing drivers, but definitely a whole lot farther than you can get today compared to a Win32 app. On the other side of things, we want to make sure that the desktop bridge has less potholes, perhaps, on the way to get TSU from your WinForms and WPF app to a UWP. If you look at the demo that Abalade showed you today, that was kind of a little bit of that spirit of kind of moving forward. And there's a great session tomorrow at, I think, 2 o'clock that Mike Batista is doing, which basically is the hour-long extended remix of that, starting from a WinForms demo instead of a WPF app. basically moving that forward, you know, adding a bunch of Windows 10 APIs. He's got a preview of some a really cool technology we're working on that's going to let you take UWP XAML and put that inside of a Win32 application. So go check that out and tweet about it if you're interested. And then, you know, really make those two worlds a little more seamless. Like the mental model I'd like to think about is that all the technologies we built in the last 5 years in Windows are can be like switches that you can just turn on, right? So right now it's a big pill you have to take. And you know, there's a lot of people that might want to use might want to run inside of an app container for the security boundary, but they might not want maybe the lifetime management limitation, right? So there's various aspects of it, and we've kind of made it all together, and we want to kind of detangle these things apart so that people can kind of flick on the switches as they need them. And so that's kind of that's the direction we're headed, not necessarily, you know, something different.
Right, okay. So I was a little bit worried, especially on the XAML side of things. That's where things really...
So are you asking more about the XAML standard announcement, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about that as well. Don't know if that's something you could field as well.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So actually, Joe Stegman and I were just... we recorded a podcast with the .NET Rocks guys earlier today talking about this, which is... So we had more time to even, you know, kind of get that discussion out. But basically... The way that XAML standard is being built is basically looking at what's in UWP today, and which is really a subset of what was from WPF and Silverlight, and then what's in Xamarin Forms. And Xamarin Forms was evolved out of the idea of taking something that was XAML from the perspective of the XAML XSD, you know, XML schema, and making something that was as similar as it could be given cross-platform limitations on the native UI platforms there. The problem is they made the assumption early on to simplify out concepts that couldn't be implemented on all platforms versus compatibility, right? So a great example is the text property is called text instead of content, right? And so they could have made it called content and made it a string instead of an object, and the XAML would have been compatible, right? But they chose to make it called text because it's a simpler concept, and why learn a complicated concept that has no bearing on that technology? So it's, you know, they made the decision one way or another. It was very rational from a simplifying standpoint. However, that doesn't help your XAML be portable. And so the model that both sides are going to do is to try and learn from each other, learn from, you know, what's possible everywhere, and learn from what is the set of things that, you know, everyone just uses kind of on Windows, and kind of add the set of functionality to both sides so that there's no breaking changes, but you basically have this kind of holistic, you know, polyfilled superset, or kind of subset, but it's a filled rational subset that works everywhere and is a good set. So it's, you can, you know, the spec is up now, the V1 version of that. You can go, you know, give feedback on that in GitHub, and there's already been a bunch of feedback on it, which is pretty cool. But that's how we're thinking about doing XAML standard. So we, as someone who's worked on WinForms and then Silverlight, you know, basically I've been doing client UI libraries my entire career, acutely aware of that pain.
So, thank you.
Trying to avoid it.
All right, thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering if there are any plans with C# and/or .NET Standard over WebAssembly.
So, WebAssembly.
Yeah.
WebAssembly.
That's a good one.
So we have talked about it. I mean, it feels to us still like a bit of a nascent technology. I know Miguel has been experimenting with it a bit, but we don't have any specific plans on it. I mean, the one place where it would be interesting to us is, you know, we've got great technology for building desktop apps and for building mobile apps. And so the one thing that we're kind of missing, at least from a C# standpoint, is apps that can run in the browser. So that's obviously where WebAssembly would fit. We've talked about it, but there's no specific project. And I think it would be great to see another technology really adopt that to really show what that space looks like. I'm guessing that Microsoft isn't going to be the first mover on WebAssembly with .NET. And so that kind of goes back to the nascent technology point. So that's my answer on it.
Okay, thank you.
I have three questions.
Oh, geez. Oh.
But I think the last two are simple. The first one, we're building a client-type desktop application that will load components at load time. One of the challenges we're dealing with is that one component will have a different dependency on a different DLL than another one. And we've tried loading it in different silos, and we haven't been able to crack that. And there are things on the web that say do it this way, but it just feels unsanctioned.
Unsanctioned.
And so I'm just curious, do you have a recommendation? I would love to just compile them into a single DLL, even if it had a reference to something that came down in a new Git package. Just collapse it down, because we don't care about the size. It really doesn't matter size, but if we could just get it into one piece.
So do you control the pieces that you want to load side by side?
I'm sorry?
Do you control the individual pieces, or is it?
No, we do not. We do now, we won't always. And even if we, eventually we hope that the older components, we want to let them never have to be touched, even though we'll come out with a new version of that client. We can still load old versions.
It's not a uniquely client-side app problem either. No. Many people do this in their server-side application. I mean, it's a generic modularity issue. And there's been many patterns and frameworks released over the years, the 15 years of .NET, to try and solve this. I have opinions about this, but
I would love a check mark that I could just.
Yeah,
click.
I mean, the reality, like, this is me being opinions. The .NET guys will shut me down, I'm sure. We're all .NET guys.
You have 10 seconds.
10 seconds. the reality is, like, the runtime and the language and the way the framework is designed makes true. Like, making that a turnkey, brain-dead operation is just fundamentally very, very hard. It's very difficult. And there are primitives, like app domains and things that you can use that give you certain flexibilities, but you really need to understand what's going on when you load. And, like, so, you know, Visual Studio as a tool itself has this exact problem. Visual Studio is not built by one team. It's built by probably hundreds of teams when you consider all the different assets that go into it. But the majority of it runs in one process. It runs in devenv.exe. And so we have to battle with this ourselves when it comes to building the Premier Developer Tool.
Loading third-party code via
and then loading extensions, code, yeah. For example. And so this unification, as we call it, which is, you know, I have A and B that both want to reference C, but you want that C and you want that version of C. And the .NET was designed to be very strict from the very beginning about identity of an assembly, and that the types that are loaded out of that assembly are tied concretely to the assembly that they came from. There is really no flexibility in that beyond a very few policy sort of things that you can change, whether they're, you know, that are tied up with assembly version, strong naming, binding policy, the GAC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which makes all this very, very hard. And you can go cowboy. You can just say, yeah, load from bytes and hope for the best. You know, assembly.loadFromBytes, and it'll all be good. It'll all wash out. And then you try and share types, and you get, you know, type equivalence exceptions. That is a characteristic of the .NET runtime. And that's kind of my piece on that.
I would say that, I mean, usually what we see is when people have this, you know, shared diamond problem where different versions of C are requested, is people often say, I just want private dependencies in NuGet. Mm. But if you think that through, of course we could build private dependencies in NuGet in 10 seconds, but you wouldn't get the semantics that you want, which is you'd load both versions of C and have everything work. And like the platform where that seems to work pretty well is basically Node, because it's JavaScript, right? So the reason it works in JavaScript is because they don't have types, right? Fundamentally, when you have two instances of different versions of C, so long that the code that talks to each of them just happens to use the same sort of method names, it will all just line up. As soon as you have one instance where the guy has his, you know, the new API that the other one doesn't have, the whole thing explodes as you would expect. On .NET, it doesn't work like that, because our runtime has a really strict understanding of types. So if you have version one of that type and you have version two of that type, you can't call the method if they're both loaded, because what happens is, well, they're different types as far as the CLR is concerned.
Yeah, what I was hoping is that we could just extract the APIs or the methods that we need and just pull. I mean, it's the same thing as if I downloaded the code and compiled it with the code.
Yep.
I mean, that's the type of solution I'd like, is just.
So you want to suck out the IL.
Suck it into the DLL.
And you just, can do that. Yeah. There are tools that do that. And actually, we do that for components inside the framework itself.
Yeah. Yep.
And
but they feel unsanctioned. Do you have a.
I guess it's fair to say there's not a first class experience for that in what we ship.
Well, it is a bit more than that. I mean, there's first class, but there's also legal implications depending on what the licenses are. There's certain problems with that, but I would say that, like, if you think from a technological standpoint, sucking in the IL is logically equivalent to loading both components side by side. You still have this problem that this thing and that thing, if they both want to exchange types, it still doesn't work. So usually my answer would be what you want most often is basically when you just unify. You want to say somebody wants version 1 of the component, the other guy wants version 2 of the component. So we load version 2 of the component because it should be a superset of what both guys want, and that should wash out. Now, in some cases, it doesn't work because C did break and changes, which again, my team thinks really hard about break and changes. And our general policy is if you want sanity in your ecosystem, you really don't want to do break and changes because all you need is two different parties depending on two different versions.
I mean, we are separated by directories, which kind of helps a little bit. But I mean, it's still, I mean, it's just.
Not really.
Yeah. So I'll move on to the second question real quick. Async voids. We've used async. We love it. But we get a lot of people. They don't know what they're doing. They'll make an await. And then they'll just say, yeah, stick the async on there. And it just, I would love a different keyword for async void, just like async never use me or something. You know, just like, because that just burns us constantly.
So I mean, the reason that async, there's one specific use case where async void is the right thing to do.
Exactly, yes.
And then there's no others.
Yes,
exactly.
So, I mean, it clearly has to be enabled as a capability. Certainly, I guess we could enable an analyzer to say, don't use async void other than with event handlers.
That would be beautiful.
That's the one allowable case. But yeah, it's not super intuitive. Like, you can put async void in other places, and it's not obvious until the bad things happen, like exceptions don't flow correctly.
Correctly.
That you did something wrong. So yeah, we could look at the.
I would love it because it's just from a supervisor's position. It's really hard to catch them, you know, because people just throw them in, and you just. I wish there'd be
agreed.
A way to snag.
Totally
them.
Agree. It's particularly dangerous in system web applications.
Yes. Yeah.
So I would say that the one thing that I've seen what people do is when teams use ReSharper, what usually helps is when you have a tool that has a very in-depth understanding. Where ReSharper sucks today is that it's relatively hard to set up ReSharper in such a way that it does it during the build.
Yeah.
So one thing that our analyzers do really well is that you can just reference them as NuGet packages, you can check them in. So if you have a larger project, it is relatively easy for an architect or a supervisor to basically say, these are the rules I want my teams to follow. And you get very granular rules for that. So if you really want to, you can have an analyzer that actually not only flags it, but actually causes the build break. So you actually get an actual compilation error, if you will. Yeah. And that means you can pretty much enforce anything you want. So, for example, if you really feel strongly about var one way or the other, you can also enforce it with a build break. So I think most of the stuff where it's like, yeah, you could do A or B, but realistically it's fashion, or sometimes it's just technological choices that may be not easy to detect. I think analyzers are a better way for us to give you the tools to enforce what you want to have.
Last question, it may not be relevant here, but we fight, like, I've been trying to get our company to just embrace the user concept, but we have external equipment connected to the machine that spans user accounts, and it just seems like we fight this thing every time. Every version of Windows, every single product we come out with, they want settings to transfer between users. I'm speechless.
Well, I mean, for most users, that is the desired behavior. So can you give me a little more information about this?
A laptop will be connected to a CMM or CNN machine, which is it's $100,000, $200,000 machine. They'll have five or six users that will log into it, and there's a substantial amount of time taken to set up that machine to communicate properly with the software. And so the companies, they don't want to have to be setting that up for every single user account. There are instances when a machine-shared settings is appropriate.
So, the printer driver system has a first-class feature for this, I recall, but other drivers probably don't. Is that fair to say? Or?
Is that? I mean, I'm not sure about the specific.
I was an old IT admin guy, so I remember this type of problem. Yeah. And like with printers, you could always set system defaults for printers, and then you could lock down whether users.
Yeah, it's almost like a printer, but it's a lot more work.
Milling machine or something, is, right?
So, are you talking about? Because you obviously can still do machine-wide drivers. Are you asking more about?
Configurations, whether to prompt the user before they start the process, or because some of these CMM machines are as big as this room.
I see.
And it's like there's a lot of settings that need to be configured that are more machine specific or to the external hardware, but yet every user that logs in there, we want it to be a shared, and it seems like we just never can fit. And I try to tell my company that we shouldn't fit, but we need to.
I mean, I guess I'd love to get more understanding about what are some of the specific settings, and is it how much of it is, you know, your app and your software versus, you know, I just like to get more understanding about some of these systems.
Okay, and maybe after
we can go talk to this, we can go yell at the settings team too, which will be fun.
Okay,
we got 4 minutes left. Let's try to get two more.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is working. I don't think it's working.
Okay, go ahead.
My question is around ASP.NET Core 2.0 and running on a Pi.
We love Pi.
Okay. So can I run Kestrel and also serve up pages under SSL?
Yeah. What operating system are you running on your Pi?
Windows IoT Core.
Ah, okay.
So this is Microsoft that shouldn't be running Windows?
How do you feel about Windows?
Great. UWP, no, is the short answer to that. Kestrel cannot be booted under UWP today. And that's been an on and off again discussion. We haven't really resolved it yet. It requires platform changes in the UWP platform to be able to do some of the things we want to do. If you have device access, so you can log in as an admin, you can register a startup task using the standard Windows sort of ways of doing that, which are all exists, and you can deploy a console app effectively, which you can do on Windows 10 IoT Core on a Raspberry Pi, then you can build a standalone .NET Core application, because .NET XE itself, we have a build of that runs against one core built for ARM so that you can run it on Windows 10 IoT Core. And then Kestrel, which depends on libuv, which is a native library which we compile, we have a version of that built against one core, so in a package, and that all just kind of comes together and works. So the caveat is that, yes, you can do it, assuming that you can deploy it as a, I think they call them C++ console applications in the Windows 10 IoT sort of developer experience. You can do it that way. Basically, you PowerShell remote in, you publish it on your local developer machine for that platform. You pass that into the publish target, and you set your RIDs and all that type of, which is an experience we're trying to fix, or make better, I should say, in 2.0 moving forward.
2 minutes left.
And then you copy it over and you can boot it up from the console. You can't do it in a UWP app very easily today.
And you can set that app to, you can set them to start up every time. So that's okay.
It's just a console app at that point, so you can just use the standard Windows commands that are available on Windows 10 IoT Core to set a startup task.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We should move to the next question.
Yeah, my question goes back to the isolation thing about app domains and everything. Is there a plan to port the managed add-in framework to .NET Core?
So far, nobody asked for the managed add-in framework yet, but we
I do.
One person. Plus one.
As I said, so far. Okay, we have one vote for that. So the thing that we do have on ASP.NET, on .NET Core today is assembly load context, which is basically a way how you can spin up different isolation contexts where you can load the same, different versions of the same assembly in multiple ways, and you can unload them as well. I don't know whether we have unloading in 2.0 yet, but definitely there's a feature coming for unloading of assembly load context, which is similar.
Okay.
So you can think of these as basically a lightweight version of app domains. But if you look at the add-in framework, what it provided was a very rigid isolation model with a very complicated communication pipeline on both ends. And we found that nobody's willing to jump through the hoops to actually implement it. And so realistically, like all the big applications for which we originally envisioned it for, like Office and Visual Studio, none of them picked it up because it's too complicated. And that's why we also don't care about porting it to Core. That's my short answer.
So the answer is no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wasn't popular, is this another way of saying it?
Yep.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Sometimes we do that.
We should close for that.
We have 15 seconds.
Come find any of us in the front of the room if you want to have any more questions. We'll be around for a while. So.
Yeah, I think we're done with questions. We literally have 8 seconds left. But
if you have any more questions,
come up and talk to us.
Yeah. I will.
Okay.
If you have any more questions, find us at the booth. There's a .NET booth in the main expo hall. A variety of us are there all the time. And thanks for coming out and asking questions.
And thanks for using the platform.
Thank you.
And using .NET.